Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. David Gerber to get a better feel for how he and other faculty members apply the avalanche of new clinical research data in this field to their practices. And Dr. Gerber began by presenting an older patient from his practice facing one of the most controversial situations in thoracic oncology.
This patient is a 74-year-old man who ultimately was found to have a stage 1A non-small cell lung cancer. This was a small T1A tumor, about 1.8 centimeters, and an adenocarcinoma that ultimately was found to have an activating EGFR mutation. I think it's worth taking a moment to talk about how this came to clinical attention, because this was not through widespread systematic lung cancer screening. In August of 2009, he was scheduled for a mitral valve repair. He was a never smoker. He's actually a very prominent ophthalmologist. And in the preoperative setting, he underwent a chest x-ray, which showed a 7 millimeter left upper lobe abnormality. He underwent his surgery, and this was then followed on serial imaging, including some CT scans and PETs. And it was really about 2 years later, in September 2011, when some enlargement was noted. At that time, he underwent a wedge resection, and this confirmed adenocarcinoma. So with a staged procedure, he then underwent a completion left upper lobe lobectomy. And as I mentioned, this was a 1.8 centimeter tumor, poorly differentiated adenocarcinoma. The surgical margins were negative. Multiple sampled lymph nodes were negative. And the molecular analysis demonstrated that activating exon 19 EGFR mutation.
So I'm just kind of curious, you know, there's a lot of numeracy in adjuvant therapy of breast cancer and a fair amount in colon cancer. Did you kind of get into numbers with him in terms of what the risk of recurrence might be and whether that could be changed?
Absolutely. This patient is a physician himself, has access to the literature, has access to the internet, and had a lot of questions about postoperative therapy, both general conventional chemotherapy-based adjuvant treatment, and also whether any treatment directed at his molecular subtype might be appropriate. We did talk about the role of adjuvant chemotherapy, platinum-based doublet treatment, generally cisplatin-based, and I recommended that he not undergo that. And the reason for that is that when we look at some individual trials and meta-analyses, in the smallest of tumors, the stage 1A, postoperative chemotherapy is actually associated with harm. So not only is there lack of benefit, but those patients who receive postoperative cisplatin-based chemotherapy may live shorter. And I think the reason for that might be not only lack of benefit in terms of a cancer that would otherwise be cured with surgery alone, but the potential effects of harm.
What did you estimate his risk of recurrence was? And I don't even know if we have enough data to say whether that's changed in the presence of an EGFR mutation.
Yeah, so that's another great question. I think that this patient probably has a 5-year survival rate after surgery in excess of 70%. He is a 74-year-old man. He's otherwise in very good health. That's a number that changes substantially. If he happened to have mediastinal lymph nodes, and this was a stage 3 case at the time of resection, we're looking at a 20% 5-year survival. For a stage 2 case, we're probably somewhere between 40 and 50%. A larger stage 1, stage 1B, probably on the order of 60% or so. And all of these numbers are relevant to the benefit that we predict from the adjuvant chemotherapy.
So obviously the other question that you refer to is very controversial, related to the use of targeted therapy in the adjuvant setting. And I'm really curious about the so-called Alchemist trial. I know you're very much involved with that. Really exciting, long overdue, I think, too. First of all, how do you approach these patients outside a trial setting right now? You know, again, a physician, I mean, I kind of wonder whether if I were in that situation, I would maybe want to take a shot at an EGFR TKI, but you know, who knows? But what's your approach outside a trial setting, and what'd you do with him?
Yeah. Ultimately, I did not recommend an EGFR inhibitor for this patient. You commented that the Alchemist trial is long overdue, and I couldn't agree more. We've known about erlotinib as a drug for a long time. We've known about its particular efficacy in EGFR mutant lung cancer for a long time. And yet we still don't know what the role of those drugs is in the postoperative or adjuvant setting. What studies are out there to guide us? There was a study by the NCI Canada, the BR19 trial. It took me a long time to realize that BR does not stand for breast, it stands for bronchus in the Canadian system. This was a study that was intended to enroll over 1,200 patients with resected stage 1B through 3A lung cancer, and then randomize those patients to gefitinib or placebo. The study was stopped early because a concomitant phase 3 trial of gefitinib failed to show a survival benefit. So there were only about 500 total patients enrolled in that study. And it looks like in the end, there were probably fewer than 20 cases that had EGFR mutations. But of that very small number of cases, there was no benefit seen of gefitinib and possibly a harmful effect. Now, again, the numbers are very small. The confidence intervals are wide. But the hazard ratio in that small subset of patients is about 3.2. Why is this? Is this chance? Is it underpowered? Could there actually be a harmful effect, as sometimes we may have seen with gefitinib used in the post-chemoradiation setting for stage 3 disease? Or maybe these patients didn't get a long enough duration of therapy. Clearly, that doesn't answer the question. There's the RADIANT trial that just completed enrollment. That's almost 1,000 patients, 2-to-1 randomization to erlotinib versus placebo. That has completed enrollment. It's double-blinded. We're awaiting those results, and we'll see what the subset of EGFR mutant cases looks like. There are Asian studies in Japan and China that are ongoing. They're in EGFR mutant cases, so they're getting closer to the question. But those cases are looking at postoperative EGFR inhibitor versus postoperative chemotherapy. So the question we're trying to answer now through the Alchemist-related studies is, what is the role of molecular targeted therapy in these molecularly defined subsets after surgery, after postoperative chemotherapy if indicated, and after postoperative radiation if indicated? And so the Alchemist trial is a huge effort sponsored by the NCI, and Alchemist stands for the Adjuvant Lung Cancer Enrichment Identification and Sequencing Trial. And ultimately, this effort is going to try to enroll patients and collect data on up to 8,000 resected non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer cases. So this is truly a national effort. This is not an effort limited to the NCI or NCI-designated cancer centers. We're really hoping to get widespread community participation to answer questions that we've had now for the better part of a decade. And how it works for these patients is that they've had their surgery, their tissue is sent for central testing. For patients who have an EGFR mutation or patients who have an ALK fusion, we have specific therapeutic clinical trials that they can be enrolled on. So the Alliance has a study of adjuvant erlotinib for the EGFR mutant population, and that looks to enroll about 430 patients. In ECOG, we have a study of adjuvant crizotinib for ALK-positive cases. We're looking to enroll about 380 patients. For both of these studies, the primary endpoint is overall survival. It will be a challenge to identify these cases, we believe. ALK positivity is probably about 5% of advanced non-small cell. We don't know if it's 5% or less of early stage resected non-small cell. In both of these trials, we're giving the treatment, the targeted therapy, for a 2-year time period. And do we know that that's the right period of time? We don't. There is an inflection point in the recurrence pattern of lung cancer such that the majority of recurrences do happen within 2 years of the surgery. I think that's why you see surveillance patterns change to a less frequent timing after that 2 year period. But there was an earlier trial, a single arm study, the SELECT trial of EGFR mutant cases, where clearly during the 2 year period of adjuvant EGFR inhibition after surgery, the disease-free survival was very good. But after that 2 year period, we did see recurrences start to happen at that point. And I think we also know from breast cancer with adjuvant hormonal therapy, we know from gastrointestinal stromal tumor with adjuvant imatinib, that sometimes longer therapy may be better than shorter. That's a question that we won't be able to answer in this setting.
And I guess we should note that that SELECT trial was only one arm, so we don't really have a definitive answer. Although, as you said, it was really interesting. They had so few recurrences while people were being treated. I wonder also, relating to ALK as well as EGFR, about the next generation of agents that are going to come along. I mean, obviously, we have to kind of start here. But, you know, particularly in terms of tolerability, you know, whether or not maybe second and third generation inhibitors, you know, might work better in the adjuvant setting. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, that's another great question. I think in terms of tolerability, I think our current drug choices are probably pretty good ones. I'm sure you've had others as part of your program discuss the toxicities of crizotinib, the visual toxicities, the floaters, the shadows, low-level gastrointestinal toxicity, some change in renal function. Many of those toxicities with ongoing therapy may actually improve over time, particularly the visual toxicities. I think for reasons that are not entirely clear, when I've had patients that are on long-term crizotinib, and many of my patients are, you know, I'll hear a lot about floaters or flashing lights, especially when a patient goes from a dark room to a light room, like turning on the light in the morning or going in the bathroom or driving at night. But once they've been on it about 4 months, 6 months, they tell me that's happening much less. If there's a single toxicity that I feel becomes more problematic over time, my patients who are on 12 months, 18 months, 24 months, that might be peripheral edema, lower extremity peripheral edema. And most of the time, that's pretty mild. And most of the time, I tell my patients that if they're okay with that slight cosmetic change, that I'm not going to try to address it. And it's something that they live with that doesn't cause symptoms. And again, if I were describing this on a physical exam, this would really be trace peripheral edema.
You know, you also brought up the issue of testing tumor specimens in the adjuvant or locally advanced setting, which up until not too long ago, I wasn't hearing very much support for from investigators, and now I am, you know, obviously in terms of eligibility for trials like this, but I find that maybe there's been a shift in general about testing, and I'm curious what your algorithm is in metastatic disease. I've heard people say, you know, anybody with an adenocarcinoma, regardless of smoking history, is going to get tested. I've heard, you know, people talk about testing smokers who have squamous. What's your algorithm?
Yeah, so I think that's a dynamic and debated issue in oncology. I think the NCCN, the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, and I think it's the American College of Pathologists, the ACP, have given us some pretty good suggestions. Their current recommendations are to focus your testing on patients with stage 4 disease. And I think outside of a clinical trial option in earlier stage disease, that's probably reasonable. Let's think about the patient that we discussed earlier who had the resected EGFR-positive tumor. Let's say he develops recurrent disease in the future. Do I know that that's EGFR mutant disease, or is that actually another type of molecularly defined cancer? So I think outside of a trial setting in resected disease, it may be hard to know what to do with that information at this point in time.
I guess one thing I've heard people say is suppose the patient on recurrence ends up in an ER and they're sick and, you know, you really want to know, even though, I mean, I guess theoretically it could change. I mean, you might want to comment on that. How often do you see changes from the primary to metastatic disease and mutation status, incidentally?
Yeah, so I'm not sure I've seen enough cases of resected disease that have a molecular phenotype identified for me really to answer that question. Do we have patients with a locally advanced type cancer for whom molecular profiling happened to be performed? Yes. Do we tend to see the same molecular profile at the time of a truly advanced metastatic recurrence? We do. But I also think that that's a different clinical paradigm than a patient with a 1.8 centimeter resected tumor. I think your point is very well made that having the molecular profile known can be beneficial. What if in the future there's insufficient tissue to test? What if in the future the resected specimen is no longer available? I do think there is something nice about patients knowing, well, when I had that earlier cancer, that was an EGFR mutation positive cancer. And I do think that's something that just could be helpful for a patient to know as they go through their care, even though as a physician outside of a clinical trial, I don't necessarily know what to do with that information therapeutically at this time. In terms of the stage four patients that I test, I think right now the umbrella term that I would apply is probably non-squamous tumors that I'm sending for testing. And there is a distinction between adenocarcinoma and non-squamous. The non-squamous, presumably not only including adenocarcinoma, but also large cell, sarcomatoid. There are plenty of cases still where my pathologist, just because of the histologic appearance or the immunohistochemical profile, can't give me a histologic subtype. I just know that it's non-small cell cancer, and based on the overall clinical picture, I'm convinced that it's a lung primary. I may send those for testing. Do I ever send squamous cases for testing? Not routinely. Some exceptions might be a never smoker who winds up with a squamous designation. Another one might be a very small specimen or a scenario where my pathologists are less confident in their squamous designation.
Another question is in terms of new agents. First, I want to ask you about is afatinib, obviously now approved as an EGFR TKI. What are your thoughts about it, and what situations, if any, are you using it?
So afatinib, or BIBW2992, is what we call a second-generation or irreversible EGFR inhibitor. I think the impetus behind second-generation inhibitors was to try to get around this T790M resistance mutation. When you think about a disease like CML, chronic myeloid leukemia, it's the second-generation inhibitors that are thought to help overcome the T315I resistance mutation, which is analogous to the T790M. I think with the second-generation EGFR inhibitors, it's not entirely clear to what extent afatinib has efficacy in that particular subtype. We have had a number of large clinical trials with afatinib, but in those trials, only a small proportion of cases have T790M, and it's difficult to tease apart whether the efficacy in that population is different than it is with a first-generation inhibitor such as erlotinib. We do know that afatinib is associated with a progression-free survival that's probably a little over a year in EGFR mutation-positive cases. In separate clinical trials, erlotinib is associated with a progression-free survival in that same EGFR mutation population, maybe a little bit under a year. That is probably comparing apples and oranges, and we just don't know whether in terms of efficacy there's a difference. What about tolerability? I do think that the toxicities of a drug like afatinib are probably more than they are with erlotinib. Yes, we see rash. Yes, we see diarrhea. We probably see more diarrhea. But we probably also see more paronychia and more mucositis. You know, we're starting to see clinically meaningful mucositis probably in about 15% of patients on afatinib. I do not have widespread use of afatinib in my practice. Off protocol, most of my patients with EGFR mutations are probably receiving erlotinib. There have been cases where I've had a particularly young patient who's been particularly interested in the most powerful therapy available for EGFR mutation positive cases, and I have given afatinib in those instances.
Now, there's a trial that I've heard is out there looking at afatinib, cetuximab. What about that combination, and is that something you ever consider outside a trial?
So I've not used that combination personally. That's a combination that's been studied by William Pao and Leora Horn at Vanderbilt, and their initial studies looked very promising, specifically for that T790M mutation. And what they're doing is they're achieving dual inhibition. The antibody is blocking ligand activation. The tyrosine kinase inhibitor is directly binding to the intracellular tyrosine kinase. The limited experience reported so far suggests that that combination looks relatively well tolerated. Again, I have not used that combination personally, but we hope to see larger trials of that combination be taken forward, either in the cooperative group setting or another forum.
Now, I've heard there also, and I'm hearing about, I guess, third-generation EGFR inhibitors and more targeted on EGFR mutations. I've heard less rash and diarrhea. Any experience or knowledge about that?
Yeah, so I do think it's worth, again, just clarifying what these terms mean. So again, a first-generation inhibitor being a reversible inhibitor. So erlotinib is binding to the EGFR tyrosine kinase, and then it's coming off. The second generation being irreversible or covalently binding, and the third generation, as you've remarked, thought to be specific for the EGFR mutant molecule. I have to say that I've been fairly impressed with the data that I've seen from these drugs, not only in terms of toxicity, but I think we're starting to see signals of efficacy in, say, T790M populations that look really promising, that are starting to look like what we see for second generation ABL inhibitors for the T315I and CML.
And finally, what about the new ALK inhibitors? I know there's one called LDK378, and then alectinib is another one I've heard about. What about those agents?
Yeah, so these agents have been under study both in crizotinib-naive populations and in crizotinib-failure populations. I have fairly extensive personal experience with the LDK378, treated a number of patients on trial. And what I can tell you is that a substantial proportion of patients who've truly progressed on crizotinib have a true response to these second-generation drugs. And I'll give you a particular instance of a woman in her mid-70s who, despite having ALK-positive lung cancer, really only had disease control for probably 4 months on crizotinib. She came off crizotinib and immediately went on our trial of LDK378, and she's been on that drug for about 10 months. She's required a dose reduction, so the initial starting dose of that drug is 5 150-milligram pills, so 750 milligrams. And at that dose, a fair proportion of my patients do have diarrhea, do have nausea, and perhaps more problematically in the long term, develop a transaminitis that can be real. You know, AST, ALT in the 400 to 600 range, typically not a dramatic change in the bilirubin. In all of these instances that I've had personally, that has reversed upon holding of the drug, and we tend to go from the 750 dose to the 600 milligram dose. And in really all of those cases that I've had so far, they have been able to tolerate that lower dose and have ongoing disease control for months thereafter.
So maybe we can talk about your next case, the 62-year-old lady. And I've got to say, I really like the oncology grand rounds thing that you did in the JCO. I like those series in general about maintenance therapy. And I got to say, I don't know, is your lady, is this case the same one there? It seems very similar.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's right. There are not many lung cancer patients who've got chest disease and their single site of extrathoracic disease is within the spleen. Indeed, to prove that that was metastatic lung cancer, we biopsied that lesion in the spleen to prove it.
So the thing that I think is interesting, though, is that the case write-up you provided today is a little farther along in her course. So you kind of find out what happened. So maybe we can kind of use your case and use this case as a way first to get into the issue of maintenance and then to get into the issue of, you know, recurrence and experimental therapy that this lady gave. But maybe you can kind of go back and talk about how she presented and what her initial therapy was and some of the points that you got into in this great paper.
Well, so just to review the case itself, this is a 62-year-old woman who initially presented after having a transient ischemic attack, otherwise excellent health, really a performance status of zero at the time. And at her time of progression, she was noted to have a right lung mass, a suggestion of ipsilateral hilar mediastinal adenopathy, underwent a biopsy confirming a lung adenocarcinoma. And only after that point did she undergo a PET scan, which really lit up intensely within the spleen. And a biopsy there demonstrated lung adenocarcinoma consistent with metastatic disease. Now, I guess it's worth talking about my selection of initial therapy. She recovered from her TIA completely.
Can you also mention, before you get into that, her molecular findings?
Absolutely. So she had an activating KRAS mutation. She specifically had a G12C mutation. And just to review KRAS mutations perhaps briefly as a topic, after P53 mutations, these are probably the single most commonly found mutation in human cancer. I'm sure you've talked about in your GI programs, right? 80 to 90% of pancreatic cancer, 40% of colorectal cancer, probably 20 to 30% of lung adenocarcinoma. We recognize that these are predominantly found in patients with smoking history, but about 5% of never smokers with lung cancer will have KRAS mutations. And it's interesting that there are some subsets of KRAS mutations that are really specifically linked to smoking history and some that are not. And it has to do with the biology of tobacco injury and tobacco mutagenesis. Most KRAS mutations in lung cancer are at codon 12, as this patient's is. Some are in 13, and it's very rare to find one at 61. As I mentioned before, we don't specifically have therapy directed for KRAS mutations that's clinically approved. We do have multiple clinical trials. KRAS has been looked at both as a prognostic marker in lung cancer and as an indication for specific therapies. And I think in terms of prognosis, it's not entirely clear. I think for a long time in the postoperative setting, we thought it predicted poor outcomes for resected early stage cancer. I think we thought it predicted resistance to adjuvant conventional cytotoxic platinum doublet chemotherapy. But Frances Shepherd and her group recently published a very large series from the LACE meta-analysis of resected early-stage lung cancer, hundreds of cases, and that prognostic value was no longer entirely clear. I think what is evident from KRAS mutations in lung cancer is that they probably do predict resistance to EGFR inhibitor therapy. And in some trials, EGFR inhibitor therapy in the KRAS mutant population may actually look like it causes slightly worse outcomes than no therapy. Those are very small subsets. It's really hard to say one way or the other. Now, in colorectal cancer, we think of KRAS mutations as predicting resistance to anti-EGFR antibody therapy, cetuximab, panitumumab. That's a little bit less clear in lung cancer.
But the bottom line is, from the point of view of this patient, I guess the thinking would be she wouldn't have any targetable mutations. And therefore, I mean, one of the terms we've talked about is pan-wild type, although that's pretty inaccurate, I guess, but more the lack of driver mutations. Can you talk about kind of how you thought through her initial therapeutic plan in terms of initial therapy and then the question of maintenance?
Sure. So given this being a patient with good performance status and a lung adeno or a non-squamous diagnosis, the first question I asked was, did I think she was a candidate for bevacizumab? And I elected not to give bevacizumab in this case. You know, there are some very clear contraindications to bevacizumab. We believe that squamous histology is associated with increased risks of life-threatening hemoptysis based on phase 2 experience of bevacizumab. Although it is notable that some very large clinical trials in lung cancer, not of anti-VEGF ligand antibodies like bevacizumab, but VEGF receptor or VEGFR2 antibodies, have enrolled patients with squamous histology with acceptable toxicity. So I don't think we really know what the role of anti-angiogenic therapy is going to be for squamous patients. Other obvious contraindications would be significant hemoptysis. And here, her recent transient ischemic attack just led me away from the drug. I think there's a lot of literature surrounding bevacizumab and thrombotic events. And I think if there's anything that I take away from it, that the increased risk may be greater for arterial thrombotic events than it is for venous thrombotic events. And that's exactly what this patient had. My thought was that if I have a 62-year-old woman who's got an outstanding functional status, if for any reason she were to experience a real stroke, that would be more devastating than the lung cancer itself. And so I just didn't want to take that risk. And that led me to choose a regimen of carboplatin and pemetrexed. Why did I choose carboplatin? Well, I'd have to say that in general, really in almost all of my stage 4 patients, I tend to use carboplatin rather than cisplatin. And I also think you could argue that if you're concerned about vascular events, they might be slightly heightened with the cisplatin rather than the carbo. And so that's how I got to the original regimen of the carbo-pem.
So this case, you obviously selected it to get into this issue of maintenance therapy in advanced lung cancer. And maybe you can comment on a little bit on some of the data that you talked about in the paper and where we stand today in this situation, both in the patient eligible for a Bev and not receiving it, such as this one.
Sure. So this particular patient got 2 cycles of carboplatin pemetrexed and had an excellent response. After 4 cycles, she continued to have an excellent response. So comparing the post-cycle 4 to the post-cycle 2 scan, really, another major shrinkage had occurred. And for that reason, I elected to go to 6 cycles of the doublet therapy. In general, if you're going to read expert guidelines, it often says 4 to 6 cycles. If I've had response after 2 cycles, but then I've stabilized at the post-cycle 4 point, I tend to stop at 4. But if I've had an ongoing response, I'll probably go to 6 as long as they're tolerating it really well. And at that point, she and I face the decision of observation versus continuation pemetrexed maintenance therapy, which we elected to do. In terms of maintenance therapy, I mean, I do think it's worth pointing out that there is a long history of maintenance therapy in adult oncology, right? In ALL, we give methotrexate, mercaptopurine, vincristine, and prednisone for 2 years. We have maintenance rituximab in lymphoma, maintenance lenalidomide in multiple myeloma. And it's probably also worth talking about some cancer biology that might be relevant to why maintenance could be helpful before we get into specific trials. There's something called the Goldie and Koldman hypothesis.
I remember that from my fellowship.
There you have it, right?
Probably nobody ever heard of that, though.
that's resistance really depends on spontaneous mutations. And so resistance increases with time. So maybe if you use a non-cross-resistant therapy early on, you may increase the likelihood of killing more cancer cells before you get resistance. And you probably also remember from fellowship the Norton-Simon hypothesis.
That was the next one I was thinking of.
Right? So that says that solid tumors are composed of faster-growing cells, which are sensitive to therapy, but also slower-growing, more resistant cells. So maybe you can achieve a maximum anti-tumor effect with using sequential or non-cross-resistant mechanisms to get at those 2 different populations. You know, there's also preclinical data suggesting that low-dose therapies, metronomic therapies over time, can have anti-angiogenic effects, can alter anti-tumor immunity. And I think there's also a real clinical rationale to think about it even before you look at the data, and that is that you probably increase exposure to effective agents if you wait until disease progression and give second-line therapy at that point. There will be a proportion of patients who are not able to receive treatment at that time. And if you move those treatments up into the immediate post-platinum doublet setting, you may increase the proportion of patients who get exposed to those therapies. That may actually be the main reason we see benefit in maintenance trials. It's not necessarily the timing of treatment that provides the benefit. It's just getting effective treatments to the patients in a higher proportion of the time.
So maybe you can just briefly talk about some of the clinical trial data that have come out in maintenance and what your take is right now. I have oncologists saying to me, quote, is maintenance standard of care?
So there have been now numerous studies of maintenance therapy. And maintenance therapy questions actually go back quite a ways in advanced lung cancer. You've got early studies looking at prolongation of gemcitabine, vinca alkaloids, and paclitaxel. And, you know, in all of those studies, what we tended to see was improvement in progression-free survival. We did not see improvement in overall survival. More recently, the thrust of maintenance studies in advanced lung cancer has really been based around pemetrexed, bevacizumab, either the agents alone or in combination. And there's also some data with erlotinib. And maybe it's worth taking a moment just to go over the terminology of all of those different clinical trials, because there have been so many. So there was recently the Paramount clinical trial. And I think the Paramount clinical trial probably fits the case that we're discussing the best. I use carbo in my case. The Paramount study was cisplatin pemetrexed for 4 cycles. And in those patients who did not have disease progression or intolerable toxicity, after those 4 cycles, they were randomized to placebo or pemetrexed. That study was notable for an improvement not only in progression-free survival, but also overall survival. 15.5 months versus about 10 months. And that's a clinically meaningful difference. Now, how do we put that in context? Well, the first thing is that both arms of that study look very good. So we need to think about who those patients are in both arms, right? Those are the patients who made it through 4 cycles of platinum doublet therapy without progression, right? Those are the only patients that are analyzed for this endpoint because they had to make it to the point of randomization. So those patients who got too sick for chemo or had disease progression before that point, they're culled out. And that's why those numbers look very different than the numbers you might see in the Point Break trial that we'll discuss momentarily. The other thing to remember about that study is that even though about 65 to 70%, I believe, of the patients who were assigned to placebo, even though they went on to get therapy at the time of progression, I believe about 4% of them got pemetrexed at that point. And we know that pemetrexed is an effective, well-tolerated, and convenient agent in lung cancer. It's used all the time in the first-line maintenance and second-line setting. It's a 15-minute infusion. I can tell patients they probably won't get alopecia. We follow their blood counts, and they do really well. And we have to ask, is there a role for a patient who had a platinum pemetrexed doublet, was observed with disease control for several months, at the time of progression, again getting treated with pemetrexed? We've seen studies of interrupted therapy looking potentially effective in prostate cancer, colorectal cancer. We've seen reports of EGFR inhibitors in lung cancer that had lost efficacy, but then after an interval of other therapy, regained efficacy when patients were rechallenged with them. So that's an important question that's left over from Paramount. It is if we had taken a break in therapy, but had given the patients pemetrexed at progression, How would things seem? And that leads maybe to a discussion not of a pemetrexed trial, but of the Phidias docetaxel trial. And I think a lot of us think of that trial as one of the cleanest of all the maintenance studies, where I believe the backbone regimen was platinum gemcitabine for 4 cycles, and then patients were randomized to immediate or delayed docetaxel. And it's interesting that I believe the overall survival benefit with the immediate, or what you'd now call maintenance docetaxel, was probably about 2.5 months. Now, the p-value was 0.09, and since we all use a threshold of 0.05, that's why you're not seeing docetaxel labeled for maintenance therapy at this time. But when you looked, about 2/3 of the patients in the delayed docetaxel arm received docetaxel at progression. That means about 1/3 of patients never got treatment at progression. Either they didn't want it, or they were too sick to receive it. But if you look at those patients who did get docetaxel, the survival for those who got it in the delayed setting rather than immediate was identical. It's about 12.5 months in both arms. Again, getting to the point of timing's not the issue at all. It's just getting the therapy.
So can you talk about, you have this great algorithm in this paper in terms of your management strategy and advanced non-small cell. What's the bottom line, though, in terms of particularly how you approach decisions about initial therapy? Let's focus on adenocarcinoma and then maintenance.
So initial therapy for a non-squamous case, if available, the molecular profile is obviously going to guide me toward a targeted therapy as first-line treatment if there's a mutation or an ALK fusion present. But let's just talk about the pan-wild-type cases. I then ask myself, is the patient bevacizumab eligible for a non-squamous case? And, you know, there's not necessarily data that guides me one way or the other, but I've had a long-standing practice in the first-line setting of using carboplatin paclitaxel bevacizumab, if I'm going to use bevacizumab in the first-line setting, and then my maintenance drug becomes bevacizumab if they haven't had disease progression. There, I tend to go to 6 cycles, if that's possible, of the triplet therapy before proceeding with maintenance, which is consistent with the original ECOG 4599 trial. I know there's been a lot of use of platinum pemetrexed bevacizumab in the first-line setting, and I also think that's a very effective and well-tolerated regimen. One of the things that we did learn from the Point Break study that compared those two regimens is that survival's not different. And I think one of the things that maybe surprised a lot of oncologists is that the overall rate and severity of toxicities was probably not different either. With carboplatin paclitaxel as your backbone, you're going to see more alopecia and you're going to see more neuropathy. But with the pemetrexed as your backbone, you are going to see more myelosuppression. By doing that, I've reserved my pemetrexed for disease progression if they've been on maintenance bevacizumab. For a patient who's not bevacizumab eligible, my first-line choice in a non-squamous case would be a platinum pemetrexed combination.